The Tom Woods Show, episode 1104.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Friends, my Away carry-on helps make my travel a pleasure. It's super strong yet lightweight, and it's even got its own USB charger built in. I'm like the king of the airport with this thing. Take $20 off your suitcase order when you head to awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code WOODS at checkout. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I am going to go over with you today some of the points that I am planning to raise at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Now, actually, as you're listening to this, if you're listening to it on the day of release, I actually gave the talk last night. But I'm recording this, actually, the day before I leave for the trip, just to have some episodes in the can, so to speak, so the rest of the week is all covered and set and ready to go for you. But in any event, I thought I would go through this because I don't know that it'll be recorded, and I know I could bring my own stuff to record it, but I don't know. I mean, I'm just running around a little bit nuts lately, so I don't think I feel like doing that. And there are some themes that are going to be raised in this talk that you folks will already be very familiar with because you listen to this podcast. So I can glide over those a bit. But anyway, I thought it might be worthwhile to talk about this because the crimes of communism, that's a pretty darn good topic. And I decided I didn't want to just sit there and give everybody a grisly catalog of all these awful crimes because that's pretty terrible. So instead, I tried to focus on where these things came from. That is to say, were the crimes of communism just a perversion of a noble idea? Was it just a noble idea that somehow went wrong because of corruption or misapplication or whatever? Or could there have been something inherent in this set of ideas that tends in this direction? So I was doing my best to try to answer that. Now, I did spend a little time going through some of the crimes. I mean, of course, everybody thinks about Stalin and the Great Terror of the 1930s. And even before that, in the early 30s, you have the terror famine in Ukraine. And I think it's pretty well established by people like Robert Conquest and Anne Applebaum that this was a deliberate famine. I mean, for heaven's sake, it's Ukraine. You've got some of the most fertile land anywhere in the world there. You would have to try through human effort to bring about a famine there of all places. And there are millions of deaths there, certainly in excess of 5 million deaths there. We could talk about China. We could talk about repression and totalitarianism in Eastern Europe. We talk about the period of Lenin, which I'm going to spend a little time on. Talk about Cambodia, where about one-third of the population was liquidated. The numbers are still debated and discussed, but they're gigantic. Whatever you say about them, they're pretty big. So again, I'm not going to go through a catalog of they did this, they did this, but why did it happen? How did it happen? Was it because of the ideas or in spite of them or what? Now, the fact is, there were plenty of leftists who did either try to cover up these crimes or minimize them or make excuses for them or ignore them. Or if you would bring up the crimes, they would remind you that, after all, Christopher Columbus was a pretty bad dude also. That would be what you would get. I saw these people with my own eyes. These people did exist. There were people who cheered on the Soviet Union. Angela Davis is a very much a celebrity on the left, and she is one of a great many people who openly cheered for the Soviet Union and very much regretted the collapse of communism. And did not say, oh, well, this is just a perversion of our system and we can't endorse any aspect of it. That was not what you heard from people like her. Now, it is true, you can find some people who say this is a perversion of our ideas and it is not anything that we would endorse. But I'm just not sure how much we can credit that. Even Trotsky, who is supposed to be the good guy, Trotsky was the one who, if only we had listened to him, if only he hadn't been persecuted, we might have had a humane communism, but he actually thought, and we'll get into this later, that the principles of war communism were actually just plain old communism. And the principles that we have sometimes hear called war communism were crazy. They were the worst possible, most extreme possible version of communism. And he said, yeah, this is just regular. There's nothing out of the ordinary about these. These are plain old communism. So I don't know if I buy any of that. And secondly, another thing we need to know, there were people in the U.S. who were sympathetic with this and who led people to believe that this was all just right-wing propaganda and not really happening. And of course, one of the great villains in that story is Walter Duranty of the New York Times, who covered up the terror famine in Ukraine. And Malcolm Muggeridge, the British writer, did his best to try to equalize the coverage. But obviously, if one person is saying there's a terrible famine and another person is saying, I don't know what that guy's talking about, I'm right here and everything is fine, well, at the very least, there's some doubt in your mind. Well, maybe it's unclear. Who's to say? Maybe this is propaganda. That is a problem. Now, Duranty, it's true, he won the Pulitzer Prize, but he did not win it for his reporting on the famine. So just so people understand that, he won it for reporting he had done in Russia a little bit earlier than that. So it's not quite as bad as you may think it is, but still, you know, not a guy you'd want. They have an asterisk next to his name, I believe, when they list the Pulitzer Prize winners that they've had over at the New York Times. Anyway, you may recall, if you're a longtime listener of the show, that I did an episode by myself, but it was hundreds and hundreds of episodes now, I believe, in which I went through an article written by Eugene Genovese, who was a Marxist for most of his life. I mean, this is a guy who openly said, I do not fear a Viet Cong victory in Vietnam. I welcome it. So he wasn't saying, well, this will be false communism and we can't endorse any of that. There was none of that. He was quite clear that that's what we want. This is the system we want, and we're going to cheer for it. Well, in 1994, Genovese wrote an article for a left-wing periodical called Dissent, and his article was called The Question. And what was the question? The question was, with regard to the crimes of communism, what did you know, and when did you know it? And he comes right out and says, what did we know, and when did we know it? We knew everything essential and knew it from the beginning. He indicts them just like that. And I went through that article and made a whole episode out of it because that's something well worth reading. So let me share a couple passages from that article here, because that's another thing I will have done by the time you hear this. I am going to quote this because here's Genovese saying, the horrors of communism came from our ideology, not from a perversion of it. He said, especially amusing has been the spectacle of those who pronounced themselves anti-Stalinists and denounced the socialist countries at every turn, and yet even today applaud each new revolution, although any damn fool has to know that most of them will end up in the same place. For that matter, how could we have survived politically were it not for the countless liberals who, to one extent or another, supported us, apparently under the comforting delusion that we were social reformers in rather too much of a hurry, a delusion we ourselves never suffered from. Then he goes on, the horrors did not arise from perversions of radical ideology, but from the ideology itself. We were led into complicity with mass murder and the desecration of our professed ideals, not by Stalinist or other corruptions of high ideals, much less by unfortunate twists in some presumably objective course of historical development, but by a deep flaw in our very understanding of human nature, its frailty and its possibilities, and by our inability to replace the moral and ethical baseline long provided by the religion we have dismissed with indifference, not to say contempt. He continues, our whole project of human liberation has rested on a series of gigantic illusions. The catastrophic consequences of our failure during this century, not merely the body count, but the monotonous recurrence of despotism and wanton cruelty, cannot be dismissed as aberrations. Slimmed down to a technologically appropriate scale, they have followed in the wake of victories by radical egalitarian movements throughout history. We have yet to answer our right-wing critics' claims, which are regrettably well documented, that throughout history, from ancient times to the peasant wars of the 16th century, to the reign of terror and beyond, social movements that have espoused radical egalitarianism and participatory democracy have begun with mass murder and ended in despotism. Let us give ourselves some credit. Through it all, we have preserved a rich sense of humor. the destruction of hierarchies, elites, and authority, is to be effected through the concentration of power in a Leviathan state miraculously free from all such reactionary encumbrances. Well, related to this is the good Lenin, bad Stalin myth that I referred to in another episode a long time ago. This is the way my own professor of 20th century Russia put it, Vladimir Brovkin, who was one of the Russian Jews who was allowed to emigrate to the United States in the 1970s. And he was extremely anti-Bolshevik. He was actually a scholar of the Mensheviks, which was the other, which was the, shall we say, less extreme wing of the communists. Well, anyway, Lenin is somebody I'm going to be talking about in more detail in tomorrow's episode, because tomorrow's episode I'm going to run through a bit of the Russian Revolution with you. Now, I've done an episode on the Russian Revolution. This one's going to go into more depth, and I think you're going to like it. So I don't want to dwell too long on some of this, but there is a portion of my talk in which I talk about whether communism in the Soviet Union wound up being a Stalinist perversion of an otherwise good origin. So that is to say, I take this project of mine and I apply it to a particular case. Did the Soviet Union, did the Bolshevik Revolution start off really well and only later it was perverted into murder and misery and all that? And to do that, you have to look at the figure of V.I. Lenin. And so I spend some time on that, but there's an interesting quotation I give from a colleague of his who says, his principal Einstellung, to use the now popular German psychological term, was hatred. Lenin took to Marx's doctrine precisely because it found response in that principal Einstellung of his mind. The doctrine of the class war, relentless and thoroughgoing, aiming at the final destruction and extermination of the enemy, proved congenial to Lenin's emotional attitude to surrounding reality. He hated not only the existing autocracy, the Tsar, and the bureaucracy, not only the lawlessness and arbitrary rule of police, but also their antipodes, that is, their opposites, the liberals and the bourgeoisie. That hatred had something repulsive and terrible in it. For being rooted in the concrete, I should even say animal, emotions and repulsions, it was at the same time abstract and cold, like Lenin's whole being. Now, as I say, in tomorrow's episode, we're going to talk a lot about Lenin, so I will pass over much of this particular section of my talk, but let it suffice to say that the point is that Lenin was actually a really, really horrible person who would respond to, let's say, an economic problem with the firing squad. There was no sense that maybe I should try to understand economics a little bit better. Of course, what was there to understand? He had all the scientific knowledge there was because he was a Marxist. So what does he need to learn anything else for? So you would get references to and instructions given to firing squads and talk of extermination of enemies and things of this sort. So the question of the good Lenin, bad Stalin myth can be quickly dispensed with. And of course, the idea that you could have a system in which the government is going to take over wholesale and retail trade, the banking industry, transportation, I mean, all the means of production all along the line, and not wind up with a suffocating bureaucracy at the very least is terminally naive. How could you not expect there to be a sprawling regime, the likes of which the world had never seen? No regime had ever had this kind of preposterous ambition. Of course it's going to wind up being a large-scale regime. Now, in terms of it being a regime perpetrating terror on people, which is already going on with the Red Terror by 1918, that also follows from the nature of what the regime is trying to do. And here I want to refer to a great article by George Riesman, who's also been a guest on the show. He's professor emeritus of economics at Pepperdine University. He more or less argues that the chaos that is bound to result from the systematic application of communism will yield black markets, because people won't be able to get the things they need in the quantities and quality that they need. And so they will take care of themselves one way or another, and a black market will arise. Now, in my talk, I intend to spend some time talking about the role of prices, where prices come from, and what happens when you interfere with prices. And I'll talk about exactly what the Bolshevik regime did. And again, you'll hear this in tomorrow's episode, what the Bolshevik regime did that did indeed interfere with the free price system. And the fact that you've got all these idiot Bolsheviks who have no experience running anything, now they're nationalizing all these sectors of the economy and they're going to run them all. So the result is just hideous everywhere. Not to mention Lenin goes to war with the countryside because the communists view the peasants as being reactionary and backward and the class enemies of the industrial proletariat. So what they're going to do is go out in the countryside and demand that the peasants turn over the excess food they must be hoarding. Now, the Bolsheviks will decide what constitutes excess food, and they'll just grab it from these people. And obviously, the result of that is that the peasants the next year will plant less so that therefore they can be less likely, they'll be less likely being accused of having an excess if they plant less. So they plant less, and this combined with other factors yields you a famine, basically. So it's an absolute disaster everywhere you look. And the result of all this chaos and madness, the fact that the Bolsheviks tried to go without money, seriously, they tried to basically destroy the currency and return to a state-administered barter. So you had massive, you had hyperinflation, total chaos. So therefore you have a rising, necessarily, a black market. And it's just like what happens under price controls, except imagine an entire regime operated according to price controls. And what Riesman is going to say is that the way to deal with the black market would be severe penalties. Of course, you can't deal with the black market by just getting rid of all the controls on prices and the centrally planned economy and the economic chaos, because that would be to give in ideologically. That can't happen. So instead, black markets, which simply are people freely buying and selling, have to be met with severe penalties combined with a great likelihood of being caught and then actually suffering those penalties. And as Riesman points out, just charging people, you know, assessing fines is not going to be enough of a deterrent. So because they'll just incorporate that as another business expense. So if they're going to be really serious about the price controls, they're going to have to impose penalties that we associate with something like a major felony. But again, just having the penalties on the books is not enough. You have to make it actually dangerous to conduct black market transactions. The regime has to make people fear that engaging in a black market transaction, they are running the risk of somehow being discovered by the police and actually being imprisoned. And in order to instill that kind of fear, therefore, the regime has to establish an army of spies and secret informers. So people have to be afraid that if they're in a store, that if they engage in a black market transaction, some other customer will report on them. And here's Riesman's own words. He says, "Because of the privacy and secrecy in which many black market transactions can be conducted, the government must also make anyone contemplating a black market transaction fearful that the other party might turn out to be a police agent trying to entrap him. The government must make people fearful even of their longtime associates, even of their friends and relatives, lest even they turn out to be informers. And finally, in order to obtain convictions, the government must place the decision about innocence or guilt in the case of black market transactions in the hands of an administrative tribunal or its police agents on the spot. It cannot rely on jury trials because it is unlikely that many juries can be found willing to bring in guilty verdicts in cases in which a man might have to go to jail for several years for the crime of selling a few pounds of meat or a pair of shoes above the ceiling price." So it leads naturally and inexorably toward the kind of regime we saw firsthand in the case of the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century. Now, before I continue, let me say a quick word on behalf of a sponsor whose product makes my experience in airports so pleasant. And that, of course, is the Away suitcase, which I will for sure be taking with me to Santa Barbara. That thing glides through that Orlando airport so beautifully with the four 360-degree spinner wheels. It lets me charge my phone, tablet, e-reader, anything that's powered by a USB cord, plug it right into the suitcase. No looking under people's legs. Is there an outlet here? Or everybody's crowded that little power station and you can barely get in it. Who needs it? Just use your away suitcase. They have 9 colors and 4 sizes. 2 of the sizes are carry-ons. It's super lightweight and yet super strong. It's got all kinds of terrific features, plus a lifetime warranty. If anything breaks, they'll fix or replace it for you for life. And they'll give you a 100-day trial. Live with it, vibe with it, travel with it, Instagram it. If at any point you decide it's not for you, return it for a full refund, no questions asked. But you won't, because it's the most awesome suitcase you will ever use. And plus, you get 20 smackers off one of those suitcases when you go to awaytravel.com/woods. That's $20 off a suitcase at awaytravel.com/woods. All right, back to the crimes of communism. Can't talk about away suitcases all day. Sometimes you got to go back to terrible, awful things. And I also, in the talk, wanted to deal with the objection, well, none of this was real communism, right? This is all a corruption of communism, that they never really, nobody ever really followed Marx's model of allowing the stages of history to work themselves out and have communism come about at just the right time. In the case of Lenin, you're dealing with a country where maybe 1 or 2% of all the people are workers, are working in industry. And it's overwhelmingly agricultural. And this is not how Marx is said to have envisioned communism coming about. So, or the idea of a vanguard of the proletariat and all that. All these ideas associated with Lenin, there'd be people who say, this itself is a perversion of communism. We never really had communism, so therefore it hasn't been tested, and we can't blame it for any of these crimes, and we can't blame it for any of the resulting chaos that we saw economically. And I dispute that, because I would even be willing to say, let's state, for the sake of argument, let's stipulate that none of this, absolutely none, was real communism. None of it was real communism. Let's say that. Because it's true that sometimes people say, well, we're always saying that this or that isn't real capitalism, so why don't we let these people say that they didn't have real communism? I do think there's a difference there, but all right, how about for the sake of argument, we grant that. The difference is, I can show that pure communism has to lead to intractable problems, whereas they can't persuasively show the same thing for capitalism. And the main way I would do that is by pointing to what Mises discovered, namely the socialist calculation problem. We've done at least an episode or two on the socialist calculation problem, so I'll try and remember to link to related episodes and stuff on the show notes page, which would be tomwoods.com/1104. But I may as well just give a brief overview of it now and just give you the idea. The idea of the socialist calculation problem runs like this. The primary problem with socialism is not so much that if people are given equal shares of a common storehouse, then people won't work as hard, or they won't work at dirty jobs, because what's the point? I get an equal share no matter what work I do, whether it's attractive or otherwise, or maybe I'll just decide to be lazy. That's not the primary problem, because maybe you could somehow program people, you could brainwash them into being willing to be garbage men or working really hard, even though they don't get extra money or all that. Let's say you could brainwash people. So we could at least conceive of brainwashed people doing the grunt work of communists, of what's called for under communism. But what Ludwig von Mises, the great economist, argued in his 1920 article, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, even if we brainwashed people, I mean, he doesn't put it this way, but even if we brainwashed people, even if we solved that problem, the problem that would then arise would be that we wouldn't know what to tell these brainwashed people to do. And here's why not. In a free price system, that is, a system in which prices are free to fluctuate, entrepreneurs can use the price system to formulate expectations about the future and to make decisions about what production process it makes sense to engage in right now in anticipation of future consumer demand. They're able to say, I believe that the combination of this factor of production with this factor will produce a good that people will be willing to pay X dollars for when I finally have it ready in the future. And I think this is the best thing I can do with the resources at my disposal. Remember that Austrians believe that the process by which the factors of production wind up having prices is called reverse imputation. that it comes from the consumer's demand for the finished product. So the classic example that you might derive from Carl Menger's book, Principles of Economics, would be suppose we have a machine whose sole purpose involves the processing of tobacco. And then let's say for some reason there is a nationwide revulsion against tobacco that takes place such that absolutely nobody wants to consume tobacco anymore. Well, then the machine whose sole purpose is to process tobacco falls to zero. Its price falls to zero because nobody demands the finished product that it exists to create. Well, that is what we mean by reverse imputation. It's not, it sounds superficially plausible to say that costs of production lead to prices, that something costs what it does because, well, you know, the costs of production are such and such, so you got to price the finished good at such and such. That's superficially plausible, but of course, that just leaves unanswered the question of where do the costs of production come from? Why are the costs of production at the level that they're at? Why aren't they at some other level? In this kind of reasoning, we just treat costs of production like they're some magic number that requires no explanation. But simply to say, oh, prices come from costs of production leaves the cost of production unexplained. To the contrary, it's that we begin with the consumer and the consumer's preferences and valuations. And these things get moved up the production structure. And it's the intensity of this demand that gives the different factors of production the prices that they wind up having. And in this way, we're able to make sure that those factors are allocated in such a way that the output of the economy is optimal from the point of view of consumer welfare, that consumer demand is met, and to make sure that consumer demand is met in the least cost way and is met in the way in which there are the fewest foregone opportunities. And what I mean by that is, there could be some firms and industries that want to use steel in their production process, but there just isn't sufficient demand for their finished product to justify their use of steel or that much steel, which is another way of saying they don't earn enough to be able to pay for the steel. And the reason they can't pay for the steel is that they're being outbid for steel by firms and industries that need the steel more urgently because they are producing goods that are more urgently demanded by consumers, and they know that because they can see it, in effect, bubbling up from the consumer level up through the structure of production. So now think of how incredibly complex this is. You have all these people with all these preferences and all different ways of satisfying those preferences and all different goods that they want and all different factors of production that could go into the production of those goods. And these factors could be allocated in all different ways. We could have this plant over here or that plant over here, or we could have this process be used or that process be used, or lumber or stone or steel. And meanwhile, you have all different firms and industries that have a use and a need for all these inputs in order to satisfy consumer demand. All these different actors, how do we make sure that everybody's plans are coordinated and that the result is an array of goods that is most in conformity with what consumers want and is produced in a way that consumers have to give up the least so that the things they are urgently demanding are definitely going to be produced and that the inputs that those firms need will be available to them and not be squandered or wasted on industries that could just as well use some other input. This all happens through the free price system. Now imagine you don't have the price system. Imagine you have no prices for the factors of production, all the things that go into producing things. Then how would you be able to calculate these things? How would you be able to figure out what should be produced in what quantities and in what methods? And I mean, just even a simple thing like I could locate my plant right next to my supplier, and that would cut down on transportation costs. But if I locate it right next to my supplier, I got to pay a lot for the land. But on the other hand, if I locate my plant, you know, 5 miles, well, let's, I don't know, 25 miles down the road, I'll get a lot cheaper land, but my transportation costs will be higher. Well, if I have prices for all those things, I can calculate and I can figure out which is the better approach for me to use. But there's no way to know that. You don't come out of the womb knowing that Well, it's always the case that having the plant closer is the best solution. Maybe it's not. Maybe some other firm more urgently needs that plot of land, and it's better for me to be down the street and just absorb the extra transportation cost. But at least I can look at the transportation cost, I can look at the land price, and I can figure out what makes sense for me. But or if I have two different ways of producing a product, and one of them involves an extra unit of lumber, but the other one involves an extra unit of stone, let's say, well, how do I evaluate? You can't compare lumber with stone. They're incommensurable. So if there's no price associated with them, then my allocation decisions are entirely blind. I'm operating completely in the dark, and I'm making perhaps destructive and wasteful economic decisions. And there's no way once I've finished the process, I certainly can't figure out if I've done a good job or a bad job, because I can't calculate profit and loss. Profit and loss is society's way of saying I've either added or subtracted value. But since I have no costs because I can't see any price for anything because there are no prices, then how could I calculate profit and loss? You calculate profit and loss by looking at your revenues and subtracting them from your costs. But if you can't have, you don't have any prices for your costs, again, you're completely in the dark. And this incredibly complex process I described can't even get off the ground. And so all these producers are acting in the dark. Well, that's precisely the problem faced by socialism and socialist planners, because there are no prices for the means of production. As Marx said, what we need is to have the means of production commonly held by the whole nation. So that is to say, we all own the stuff together. Well, if we all own it together, or as more commonly happens, the government owns it, there's no buying and selling. And it's only through buying and selling that we give rise to prices in the first place. You see that in an art auction. You see there's a work of art up for bid, and people bid on it, and the high bid wins, and that's how the price of the work of art is determined. Well, in a way, the economy is like a bunch of art auctions, except instead of just one work of art on sale, there's a whole array of goods for sale. But it's the same kind of process of give and take between buyer and seller that generates prices. Well, if there is no give and take between buyer and seller, because there are no sales, because you already own everything, one entity already owns everything, what buying and selling could possibly take place? And therefore, there are no prices, and therefore, the planners are operating in the dark, and they're trying to take this immensely complicated problem that could be dealt with only by individual private property owners and come up with some crude solution to it based on nothing. And so that means you have to run into complete economic chaos. And so there again, even the purest possible communism, let's say, where every little requirement of Marx is scrupulously observed, you still wind up with chaos, which is almost certainly going to have repressive political consequences. So you can't escape it. Communism leads to horrifying outcomes, and there's no way to fix it other than to abandon the system altogether. All right, I hope you enjoyed that. If you're enjoying the show, please do consider becoming a supporting listener over at supportinglisteners.com. You get many, many benefits, not least of which is membership in a private Facebook group that is always full of wonderful, interesting things, great people, and we're always saying, good grief, what would we do without this group? And it's the only reason we're on Facebook and things like that. It's a lot of fun, and I'm in there, a lot of great folks are in there, but it's just one of the many benefits you get as my way of saying thank you for supporting the show over at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.